Let me just say, by way of introduction, that on the back table there are some reprints of articles that you may have had access to on the internet. If not, we made some copies for your edification. There's quite a few from Israeli peace groups. And I think, as a rule, as we watch this tragedy unfold, we hear far too little from the efforts of Israelis and Palestinians to continue to work together. A lot of that is going on. We're just not made aware of it. And I'd especially call your attention to a piece by Uri Avneri called 12 Conventional Lies, where an Israeli peace activist, a man who struggled his whole life, who fought in the Irgun as a young teenager, dissects some of the what's put forward in the American political discourse as conventional truth. And I think he does a pretty good job in dispelling some of them. I guess what I want to say is, in the end, after all, there must be a political solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. That is, there must be a negotiated settlement. And the attempt by either party to impose its will by force of arms will prove to be unsustainable. I know many of you in the last year have had an opportunity to hear some of the speakers that we've brought to Santa Cruz, the Resource Center for Nonviolence, Jeff Halper and Salim Shawamre from the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, or more recently, Abdul Jawad Saleh, a member of the Palestine Legislative Council. And if you remember what they said, Abdul Jawad Saleh left for home the day that the Al-Aqsa Intifada broke out. And each of them brought, from a different perspective, the same message, which is, it's a very dangerous development to promote and enforce a peace settlement that is not sustainable. And I think what we've seen in the last month is that what was passing for a peace settlement was not sustainable. People asked me how I felt about Camp David 2. Was I disappointed? And I frankly was pleased or relieved that neither Barak nor Arafat were able to sign that treaty, because I thought neither of them would have survived as continuing their rule after signing a peace treaty that was so sorely flawed. Anyway, it's interesting to hear the voices of Israeli peace groups in the midst of all this tragedy. Bat Shalom, a prominently women's peace movement in Israel, says, keep in mind our goal, a humane and peaceful Middle East, requires that we work to eliminate Israeli occupation of all Palestinian lands and the achievement of full equality between Jews and Arabs within Israel. This remains a fervent hope of many of the people working in the Middle East. What has happened in the last 4 weeks? We've seen a massive shift in the political topography of the whole peace process and what's possible in the future. Within Israel, the relationship between Israeli Arabs and Israeli Jews is on the brink of civil war. The death of Palestinians living in Israel has really been a rude comeuppance for Palestinian Arabs who felt that they could somehow be separate from the Palestinian struggle. Within the West Bank and Gaza, the Palestinian territories, we see a struggle not only against the occupation of the Israeli military powers, we also see an intifada against the Palestine Authority. The old guard is being pushed aside, and those who've been willing to make a deal are being set aside. Abdul Jawad Saleh says, the intifada is genuine. It has not been manipulated by Arafat. It was a spontaneous explosion, an expression of unbearable frustration on the part of a people who have been asked to bear far more than they should. The Palestinians have sacrificed too much. We should respect their courage and willingness to keep on fighting. The resistance should give us hope. Hope because it points towards a sustainable peace. Meanwhile, as you unpeel the layers of the onion in the Arab world, Israel's attempt at some kind of normal relations with the Arab world is, of course, being retracted and defeated. Simultaneously, the Arab regimes are threatened by popular upset in their own countries. We've seen the internationalization of the conflict to where even Russia, not to mention the Europeans, are reinserted in the equation, playing some kind of counterbalance to the United States. And you see the kind of dramatic isolation of the United States, where the only countries that vote with us in the United Nations General Assembly are four tiny countries in Micronesia that most of us have never heard of. And finally, we see around the world in our own country especially, a rise of anti-Arab sentiment, vicious racist language against Arabs and Islam, and throughout the world, in Europe, in France, a revival of anti-Semitism of the most grotesque and brutal sort. This is the product of an attempt to impose peace that's not sustainable. It's a many of us had hopes for Oslo. Not everybody here had hopes for Oslo. I always was trying to think of the glass as half full. Rami Houri, a Palestinian journalist who lives in Jordan, I think hits the nail on the head. He says Oslo is dead, but peacemaking is very much alive. Now that's a outrageous affirmation to make in the midst of this tragedy of the last month. But he says that the in all other cases of violence by both sides since 1993, this fighting will speed up the peacemaking process and shift it qualitatively to higher levels of equity and balance that hold out greater prospects for achieving a fair and lasting peace. What he says is, in the short term at least, the barbarism of war and fear have snuffed out the idealism of hope and peacemaking, but only in the short run. Weeks or months from now, I am sure, both sides will be furiously negotiating a permanent peace accord. This week's venomous brutality emphasizes starkly that there is simply no other alternative to quickly separating the Palestinians and the Israelis into two adjacent sovereign states with equal rights. It has to have the elements of sustainability, and the two coexisting sovereign states with equal rights is essential. And again, Houri says, every violent incident since 1993 has led to a brief pause in the negotiations, only to be followed by intense international diplomacy and a faster pace of resumed peacemaking. Watching your children die or your parents cower in their homes somehow lights mighty fires beneath would-be peacemakers. We can see that diplomatic dynamic underway already this week, with unprecedented number of world powers working for diplomatic breakthrough to a very localized conflict. I mention this because I think it's tempting to get kind of depressed and bogged down by the horror of what we're watching on the news each day, but I do think that he's correct in saying that there will be breakthroughs to peace in the not-too-distant future. What will have to be the grounds for that? What makes a sustainable movement for peace and justice in the Middle East? Jeff Halper, who many of you met when he was here in January, talks about a movement, and he talks about three essential qualities that have to be undertaken by those who would support peace in the Middle East. The three immediate tasks: one, to provide protection to the Palestinians of the occupied territories in the event that Israel embarks on a campaign of punishment or intimidation designed to reassert the Oslo framework. With or without Sharon in the cabinet, in a sense he's irrelevant. The key thing is the Palestinians should be afforded the same kind of protection that the world community has demanded for other local populations under such threat of overwhelming military force. Secondly, Halper says, we have to freeze the expansion of the Israeli occupation, likely to be redoubled as Israel attempts to reassert its control and domination. And we learned today even some of the small settlements in some of the most contentious areas of the West Bank are now being reasserted as we speak with the approval of the Israeli government. And then finally, we have to help create a new framework for just peace based on international law and United Nations resolutions rather than on power politics and negotiations between sides of unequal power. So Jeff Halper, I think, gives us a kind of our marching orders. These are the kinds of things that we should be working on. I think it's very important. We're going to see an attempt to create still further facts on the ground, reinforcing the lack of symmetry in the conflict. And I think that it only makes sense that those who are advocates for peace, justice, human rights, most of the things that we hold dear and struggle for, we have to demand that those same standards be the measure against which we judge U.S. foreign policy. I agree a lot with basically what almost everybody here has said and a lot of what each of them has said. I think Stephen points us in the right direction. As people living in this country paying taxes, we can spend our whole time running from hotspot to hotspot in the global theater. But what we need to do is look fundamentally at the values that inform and shape American foreign policy, and that has to be the focus of our work. The last thing that the Israelis and Palestinians need, as far as I'm concerned, is people in the United States choosing sides. We need to join together in our opposition to a foreign policy that's based on weapons, domination, and suppression of human and national rights. Thank you.